This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Is there a conspiracy to not report what happens on the stock market? I'm David Brancaccio in New York. We don't report on each and every presidential tweet, but today I can't resist. For help on this, let's bring in Susan Schmidt, Senior Vice President and Portfolio Manager at Westwood Holdings Group in Dallas. Good morning.
Good morning.
So here's one of the president's tweets from this morning. Quote, "It would be really nice if the fake news media would report the virtually unprecedented stock market growth since the election need tax cuts," he tweeted. Susan, first of all, the stock market, that's an interesting topic. We ought to cover that sometime.
We should talk about that one day. There might be something going on there that would impact people. I don't know.
All right. So yet again, let me just mention, since the election, the Dow up 22.6%, the S&P 500 up 19.2%, the NASDAQ composite since the last election, 26.8%. So there, the fake news media has finally reported this. And in another tweet today, again, starting with the stock market, the president said, "If Congress gives us the massive tax cuts and reform I'm asking for, those numbers will grow by leaps and bounds." That's an interesting logic.
Tax cuts were something that I think the market has been expecting. The market has already been focused on this for the last, really, 16 months, thinking about how that might impact businesses' profitability. And so the market is always looking forward, not looking past, and it's looking to see how earnings streams are going to be impacted. A Republican Congress, a Republican administration meant generally that things would be very pro-business. And I think that's what we've seen reflected in this rise in the stock market, along with strong fundamentals from our publicly traded companies.
And no country is an island, even the vast United States of America. And the world's been doing better.
It's not just the U.S. economy that's trying to chug along and be in a positive direction. We're seeing support as Europe starts to do better. We're seeing good strength in Japan. We're seeing good strength in China. And so all those things are nice tailwinds that support overall global expansion.
Susan Schmidt at Westwood Holdings Group in Dallas, thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe what the president needs is a public radio membership, because 24 minutes into trading, yet again, here are the stock market numbers. The Dow is down 2 points. The S&P 500 at the moment down a fraction of a point. The NASDAQ composite down 3 points, less than a tenth of a percent. Now, here's a list of cities that should be benefiting soon from new money from the Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba: San Mateo, California; Bellevue, Washington; Moscow, the one in Russia, not the one in Maine; Beijing; Hangzhou; Tel Aviv; Singapore. Over 3 years, Alibaba will spend $15 billion to put in research centers in these places. It's called the DAMO Academy, which stands for apparently Discovery, Adventure, Momentum, Outlook. Alibaba's DAMO Academy plans to link with universities and expects to hire about 100 researchers to work on what? Well, you name it. Data mining, financial technology, human-thing interaction, thing-internet interaction. We've been reporting this week on the fresh Lean In and McKinsey study of women in the workplace covering 12 million people in America. It finds while 47% of entry-level employees are women, only one-fifth of the chiefs, chief executive, chief financial, and so forth, are female. And where are the black women at the very top? Ella Bell Smith is an expert on organizational behavior at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here this morning.
So I'm just kind of poking through the entire Fortune 500 here, Target stores, AT&T, no, Walmart, no, Kroger. I'm not finding African-American women as CEO at any of these Fortune 500 companies. What does that say to you?
Well, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all. Ursula Burns, who was at Xerox, has now stepped down. She was the only one, and she was the only one for a very long time, for at least 8 years. And there's been no African-American women in the pipeline. And I'm not surprised for another reason. My co-author, Stella Nkomo, and I wrote about this phenomena in terms of what happens to African-American women in corporate America in our book, Our Separate Ways, Black and White Women and the Struggle for Professional Identity, probably about 16 years ago. So, you know, we predicted this. We knew what was happening to African-American women, especially compared to white women. So I'm not surprised at all. I'm very disappointed, but not surprised.
I mean, there's certainly not parity even for white women when it comes to CEOs at Fortune 500. I think the number is up to 6.4%, which is an all-time high. Some are touting that. I think it was Fortune magazine, dubbed this the black ceiling. What are ways to crack through that black ceiling, do you think?
You know, we've used different metaphors. When we wrote our book, we called it the concrete wall. To be able to advance, what we know that there's several things. You have to have good mentorship and sponsorship, which means that you have to have some type of relationship, constructive, positive relationship with the managers and executives in your company. You have to perform three times as hard. You have to really contribute to the bottom line of the business, which does not include HR, which does not include social responsibility. You have to really show that you can run a business. It's very hard to do to get those positions, particularly if you're an African-American woman. It's hard if you're a white woman. It is triple time harder for African-American women and other women of color, too. This is not just a phenomena that hits African-American women. It hits us the hardest, though.
So sponsorship, mentorship, it's about fostering, nurturing, fertilizing a network within the company, I suppose, on the board, but also among senior managers as a person is working their way up.
The formula I like to use, it's performance plus relationship equal advancement. The other thing is that you have to understand, too, that women have to be, particularly African-American women, the feedback they get, performance review, is not often good. It is not often constructed in a way where the woman can use the feedback that she's getting. As a result, you really have to work with African-American women to make sure that they're getting constructive feedback, feedback that they can actually use and incorporate what they're being told to do into their daily work activities. And that doesn't happen. Doesn't often happen for white women either, but it happens less frequently. We find that managers, particularly white males, are uncomfortable giving feedback to women in general, because they're afraid to be accused of sexism. When you think about African-American women, they get really scared because oftentimes they have never had any type of relationship with an African-American woman as a colleague, as a classmate, as a teammate, as a wife, as a mother, as a sister. So as a result, they're often afraid to give the feedback because the fear of being accused of racism as well as sexism. Not knowing how to interact with a black woman. She's an unknown quantity, which makes very little sense in this day and age, but we find it holds true.
So people end up with these performance reviews that are sort of namby-pamby or nonspecific?
What we've learned is that because the women don't get constructive feedback, and sometimes they get feedback that is really inappropriate. It's too harsh. They're told that they don't fit in. They're too aggressive. They're too angry. They don't connect well with other people. They're told that they don't know how to manage their authority. And, you know, you keep getting this feedback over and over again. After a while, you start believing it. So the other thing that I know that is critically important is that you've got to rebuild their confidence. you've got to rebuild their belief in themselves. You've got to rebuild their confidence that they can succeed, that they can do it, that they are worthy, and that they have the skills necessary to really be what I call diplomatic warriors, to really get into the workplace and be able to share their visions, to be able to interact, build relationships, to be able to make hard decisions, and to be able to make a difference.
So interesting, because imagine the white guy who's trying to work his way up the corporate ranks with an eye toward someday CEO. I mean, that's going to be a tough customer. That's a person who's going to have a very good sense of himself, who you could say, hey, wait, you're being a little bit too aggressive in your career, or you're a little bit too decisive. You're not taking on enough information from your team. And with a guy, that might be seen as a positive. And you're saying that often this is used against women, particularly black women, in the reviews they get.
That's what I call the gender dilemma. Male behavior is fine as long as a white male is doing it. Male behavior is not good if a woman, particularly an African-American woman, is showing those. It creates fear. It produces conflict. People don't know how to react. But yet, white males are rewarded for exactly that behavior. Black women, if they come in too aggressive, assertive, I like the word assertive, they're told that they're angry. If they come in too tough, they're told that they need to soften. So there's no right way that they can be. The flip side of that is if you come in trying to be more nurturing and more caring, then you hear, well, you're not tough enough. So it's a very slippery slope. What I believe, though, is that when you really work with a woman and have her bring her authentic self to the table, be able to talk about, be clear about who she is, be clear about what she brings to a table with a touch of grace. I always say a touch of grace. To be able to do that, to be able to share her what I call a leadership narrative, it begins to break down some of those barriers. Sometimes you have to coach a woman to be able to take that perspective, because after a while, you start believing what you're hearing, and then you don't know how to behave. And then you wind up sabotaging yourself because you really are not bringing your full voice to the table. You can't lead. You can't make a difference. You can't contribute if you're only bringing half of yourself to work.
So with the departure of Ursula Burns at Xerox, we're left with no African-American women as CEO of the Fortune 500 to get us back to our theme.
I know. Isn't that pathetic?
And when you broaden the category to women of color as CEO, you do get Indra Nooyi, who's the boss at Pepsi, mm-hmm. and Geisha Williams, mm-hmm. who's Latina at PG&E, the electric utility. But are there companies that are taking this seriously and are doing better than others in trying to break down this ceiling for black women?
Well, you know, I think companies have a short history. We're talking as if these women are new to the workplace. If you go back, if I look at our research in our separate ways, we have second, third generation African-American women who have been in the corporate arena, who have been very successful. I think of the Bridget Hellers. I think of the Ann Fudges. I think of Jerry Devard. They're there. They're there in few numbers, but they're there. And I think we forget that black women have been on the corporate scene for a very, very long time, number one. I think we also forget that black women don't just represent a monocultural group. You have African-American women who come from high middle class, upper middle class backgrounds, who are in the corporate arena, as well as those who come in with backgrounds from working class poor. And they have different resources at their disposal to work at and to learn from. But no matter what they bring into the corporate world, it's frowned upon. And I don't know any company that consistently, and I have to say this, consistently does a really good job at this. There are periods where you have one company, and I'm not going to name names, but you have some companies that, you know, you can check the box and it looks like, okay, we've got pipeline. We've got women who are, you know, in succession that are behind these women that can move into senior positions. And then there are other years that there's none of that. And what we also know is that the pipelines don't remain, that Black women wind up, women of color wind up going to other companies where they think the grass is greener and they have a better opportunity. So they change companies. And that's a problem with pipeline, too. But I can't tell you that one company that has been consistently good at developing African-American women leaders and executives. Then that's pretty sad.
I mean, it's telling in itself that you and a collaborator 16 years ago came out with a book about this. And it's not like everything has changed since then.
Very little has changed. I think in the last 3 years, we've taken a stronger stand for women in the workplace. But when we talk about women in the workplace, we're still talking about white women and advancing white women. Very little has changed. And the stories that we told in our separate ways based on 10 years of research, those stories remain very much the same.
Ella Smith is a professor of business administration at the Tuck School at Dartmouth. Professor, thank you.
Thank you so much.
In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.